I'm Roland Perry, nominally a professor, not an academic, but was out at Monash University, and I've written 40 books, number 36 about to be published, have a background in journalism and documentary filmmaking, lived in England for 12 years, and I guess that's about it. I'm Melbourne-based, and I'm 70, so... 50 years in the business. So
okay, but when you're over here, Roland, what were you doing on the TV and which newspapers were you doing stuff for?
So when I got there, I had 5 years of solid journalism back in Melbourne, pretty tough editors and so forth, and that was good training, about 1% of the way to books, and I'd set my mind on having a crack at a book because everyone would laugh at you if you're writing a book in Australia. Amongst your journalistic mates, they all wanted to. I joined a film company and run by a guy called Jack Grossman, who was arguably your greatest, one of your great documentary makers, and I cut my teeth a lot with him. Also, a filmmaker I worked with was Tony Malam, who made Riddle of the Sands and other feature films. So I was suddenly into the film world, script writing. I wanted the extension of the business in journalism. So I didn't join a newspaper. I got a job on the Times, but didn't take it because I joined the film industry at that point. And that was a much better move for me because it opened my mind up. Didn't make the writing any better because scriptwriters are generally, they're not up to the literary side of things and vice versa. It's a great skill to be a good film writer as opposed to a book writer. So two different areas, but at least I had another string to the bow, if you like, in my career. The last 3 years of that five-year period from 77 to 1980, I was writing my first novel, failing badly, getting rejections everywhere, but eventually got up. And when you can't write, it's fascinating. I'm not being falsely modest. I couldn't write in a professional sense, but it got up and it was a bestseller worldwide, and so it gave me enough income then to develop as a writer.
So what was the topic of the novel?
The topic of the novel was wasn't a bad one, really, because I, as a journalistic, having a journalistic background, I researched it as if it was non-fiction. People would say, wait a minute, are you writing fiction or non-fiction here? Because I was doing it so heavily. So the main premise was that the Russians were running a, wait for it, running a president into the White House. It was, they were in control of a figure that was useful to them, and it was two thrillers in one, really. But the major story was that a major American corporation was selling illegally computers into Russia to control their society, and at the same time the Russians were running the corporation approved candidate into the White House, and that came out in 1979. So when all this rubbish about Trump came out a few years ago, I'm thinking, my God, I've written the scenario. But of course, Russia proved to be total rubbish for 3 years. We were buried in that here in Australia. I guess you were there. And of course, it's all fluff. I did my own homework because I have the contacts left, and it's absolute tosh about him being in Putin's pocket. But it looked good, and I thought, wow, I'm going to have a revival of that terrific book 25 years later, but it didn't happen that way.
So that was a program for a puppet, was it?
That's the one. That's number one, yeah. And that gave me, as I said, enough income to learn to write effectively. Look, most authors, if they're honest, and they're mostly dishonest about their starts, they want to gild it a bit and say, oh, I was a genius. I was Shakespeare from the start. I've been honest about it and said, no, I wasn't Shakespeare. I was a semi-literate Shakespeare. And so it takes four books for prose. If you look at all the biographies of those who've had careers in writing, you'll see they struggled till they got the rhythm of their and had a voice and confidence. It's about four books. Sorry to all the one book wonders out there listening in Bristol, but it does take a bit of time to be proficient, like every other profession and every other thing on the planet.
So when it comes to your non-fiction books, yep. I've picked out The Fifth Man because yep. The reason why is because it's a biography of largely of Victor Rothschild, very interesting figure. He was involved in the Apostles Society in Cambridge in the 1930s. He was a very central figure in the military intelligence during the Second World War. apparently retired from that after the war. Obviously, he's also from a very powerful banking family, but he was also involved in Cold War spying, as you detailed. In fact, most of the way through the Cold War, that was denied, obviously. But even after the Cold War, until he died around about 1990, I believe, then it was still denied. But you wrote the book in the early 90s, it really does kind of expose Victor Rothschild's role in that. Now, before we go into the book, do you put that amongst the top books that you wrote in terms of non-fiction?
Well, I just had to review my whole career for a book coming out a couple of years' time, and I've really probably it's number one for me in terms of what I had to do and the drive I had to develop for it. The place I had to go, I had to go to Russia several times, Washington, France, all around Australia, Tasmania, of course, where Peter Wright was. And England, of course, as well. So I did a hell of a lot of research, and I put in a 20,000-word evidential statement to the publisher, and that was the winning moment for me. The publisher said yes, and they published in England. Remember, I'd lived in England 12 years, so I knew the terrain, and I'd been published first in England, so I had a running start there. And it was William Armstrong, who probably your Bristol listeners won't know. He's died a few years ago. His daughter was Dido. Does that mean anything to you? Is it Dido?
Harding.
The singer?
Oh, right. No. It's a different Dido.
Some star singer there. I mean, I might have got the name wrong. But anyway, he's famous in himself in the literary world. And it was a great honour to be published by him. He made the comment to me. And he'd published all the key espionage books at that point. And he said, look, you have cleared up for me the whole scenario by doing the Rothschild.
Well, I must admit, Roland, I felt the same reading it, really, going through this. But let's start as a chronology here, obviously. In the 1930s, a very interesting group of young undergraduates at Cambridge University.
There were. The press got hold of the five. In other words, it was great for them to nominate, especially the tabloids, say there were five major spies, right? So everyone's running around looking for, after three had defected, that's Philby was the third one.
But hang on. Sorry to interject, but I think we have to sort of nail it right from the start. This number five was identified, as I understand it, put me right if I'm wrong, but as I understand it, from various of the British spies, they had got hints through sniffing communications of the Soviet Union, etc., that there were five top place spies, but they had no idea at the start who they were. Is that roughly right?
No, it's not. What happened was when Philby and Burgess defected, they were part of that little group you mentioned, the Cambridge set. There were about 20 key spies out of Cambridge, Oxford, and the other one, which was a great feeding ground, was the London University of Economics, all very left-wing and seduced into the KGB by the KGB. And if they were gay, that was a double seduction because they had that over them as well. You know, you're not only a spy, you're gay, we've got you. And that was the way the Russians played it, brilliantly, by the way. Of course, that doesn't work today, the gay end of it, but it certainly worked in those days because it was a very difficult business being gay for the gay community. They were jailed if they were outed. So this was a double jeopardy for them in terms of spying. So when Burgess and Maclean defected in 51, then the sniffing began. That was 1951. That's when the media, and particularly the tabloids in England, grabbed the idea and some bright spark. And it would have been, believe me, I can't say for sure, I'm betting though, that the Russians passed on the idea there are only five. Right? Ah. So you get someone down a dark alley.
I fell for it
completely and utterly. I mean, I've been inside and out this for, well, I began in 74, my first contacts with MI6, for research into that overworked thriller, the first one, Program for a Puppet. So I've been close to the community in the sense of them using me and me using them. Them using me if they wanted a story out occasionally, it was put to me. I can talk about that a little bit now in the 70s, but anyway, from the 70s, but it's half a century ago, so I think I'm at liberty. I'm not going to get shot or drawn and quartered now. But the third man who defected was Philby, and what happened was, you might remember, there were this great Kim Philby. He was another one out of Cambridge, of course, and he had a a meeting with the press in his mother's flat in London and said, I am not the third man. He was named the third man, right? And everyone, well, it can't be him. He's upper class. It can't be him. Of course it can't be him. Yeah, how stupid of anyone to say it was. And, of course, Philby was the – well, he's number two for me. He's not the key player. Rothschild was the key player. But he was right in it very heavily. Now, he was then given a job with the Observer in Beirut and went on spying for the Russians.
Okay, really, so now hang on, because what they've done is they've suspected him and they've got him out of the UK. Putting him in Beirut is a good way of saying, let's get this guy away from any of our secrets.
That's right, but with respect, Tony, you're not of the British establishment. And it was terribly embarrassing for them to have someone of their ranks being called a major spy. So they got him out. And today it wouldn't happen. There'd be much more kerfuffle now. But in those days, you're talking now 70 years ago, that was a big deal. So they got him out, but he went on spying, and then he had that effect. That's another story in itself. Don't get into that. So he's the third man, went to Moscow. So the three of them stuck in Moscow. And my main contact was Yuri Ivanovich Modin, the Russian. I interviewed him several times in Moscow in his home in the 80s and when did I do it? The 90s.
And, yeah, because I mean, let's just put this in perspective, because we've got the collapse of the Soviet Union and the fall of the Berlin Wall in 89-90. All of a sudden, you've got these people who are running British agents who are actually saying, well, it's all finished now. The Cold War's over. We're happy to chat.
Yeah, well, that's beautifully put. But they weren't happy to chat. They were being paid to chat because the ruble had dropped through the bottom, right? It had gone right to the floor. And it was $1 to 1,000 ruble. So if you turned up, as a lot of journalists did, I did, but I said, no, I'm not paying you for any book information, but I promise. And when you make a promise to the most important KGB operative, even though he's retired, he was still a big, big cheese in Russia, you fulfill the promise. So I said, if, and I will try to get a documentary made, I came back with Jack Grossman, and we filmed him, and then I gave him $1,000 US. Now, that is enough for him to live on the black market for another 12 years. So that's the way they did it, and it was the young Turks in the KGB who thought they were aping the Western system by taking a cut. In other words, yeah, we'll get you to see him if you give us 15% of what you give him, sort of thing. So that's what I got. Now, I was a little different. In fact, I think unique's often a silly word, but it's hackneyed. But no one else went in independently like me. I had a journalistic contact in Moscow. I didn't do what all the academics who should not be near these subjects, because they have no idea on how to interview these people. I mean, a lot of them, not all of them, are ex-murdering thugs, assassins. And if you're not street smart, you're not going to get anything out of them, and you're going to look a bit of a fool in the finish. Now, there was a plethora of books. You remember in the 90s, there was cartloads of thick books, 2,000 pages of the damn thing, and no one came up with anything new, really solid, because the KGB never, and let me repeat, because it'll be challenged and they have no concept of it at all, no one got inside the KGB files. No one, not me, not anyone. What they did was they'd link up with an academic from America or England, and they'd say, right, you can talk to Joe Bloggs, who's one of our great spies, but he will get the information you want from our files. So that's fraught with absolute, you can imagine how stupid that is, because they're not going to give you anything. They're not going to give you anything at all. They haven't. In fact, I'm the only person, I will puff the chest out, who's done two solid biographies on those who worked, who were very powerful, one in America and one in England, who worked for the Russians during that whole period from the Cold War, before the Cold War, World War II, and after the war. I'm the only one. And you know, I've been hammered and criticized and all that. I don't care, because I know that I got the integrity of it right. That's the key. And because I went in a different way. And I had to be very careful in Moscow, because I virtually had a bodyguard there, because a journalist was looking after me. In the 90s, in the early 90s, it was the Wild West of Moscow. You know, it was absolutely on for young and old. It was murderous difficult in the changeover to a different kind of society that they were trying to do. So it was a different period. So I got to Modin and others, about eight others, And it's not a matter of being a great skilled psychologist looking for the tick or the body language or all that rubbish. You just have to spend a lot of time with them, having done years of research and preparation, and then you get the slip up. Then you get the comment, which is a double thing, and then you go back into that. And so I've managed over time to elicit, without equivocation or any question in my mind, that it was Rothschild who was number five. We didn't mention number four, who your audience will know of, Blunt, Anthony, Sir Anthony Blunt, who was the Queen's art curator. You know about her, Tony?
Well, I know about her, and I know about him. But I mean, wasn't he involved in some sort of mission at the end of the Second World War to try and go in and grab some secret communications between the British and the German royal families from before World War One? So he was already very trusted by the royal family, but he was also apparently incredibly well trusted by the Russians. So what was he up to in the war? Because I think this is another aspect of Anthony Blunt that many people won't have heard about.
Yeah, well, Blunt was MI5. Rothschild got him in. Rothschild got Burgess into the system. That's the intelligence system during the war, and he got Blunt in. His recommendations got them in. He was, as I said to you before, a double éminence grise, if you like. He had enormous power. He was a Labour Lord. He was in the Labour Party, who had enormous pull. He was greatly respected. He was a polymath. Remember, he was an outstanding scientist. He had a tremendous record at Cambridge, and he had a great brain. I mean, too clever by half, I think, because he thought he could get away with it by being very, very clever, and he was. But he didn't over time. He made slips over time, obviously, but he was trying to do too much. But he got those guys in. He himself was an MI5 operative before the war. He operated a little bit after war, but he mainly worked loosely for MI6 after the war. That is Bond, right? For the people out there, James Bond. He wasn't James Bond, but that was British spying outside the UK. MI5 is inside.
But he played a very important role, didn't he? I mean, remember, this guy is the heir to a massive banking dynasty, the London branch
Rothschild.
But he had a very important role during the war, didn't he? Which was to do with bomb disposal, which is an amazing thing to get into. Obviously, rather hairy.
No, well, yeah, that's a bit of a That's a nice beat up for him, and it distracts from what he really did. What he really did, he had his wife involved too, Lady Rothschild, Tess Rothschild. What he did was he got himself to be the MI5 inspector of all research institutes in the UK during the war. What was he doing? Oh, he was saying, well, we can't have the Germans, our enemy, getting in to all these research facilities, whether they be microbiology, whether they be in the nuclear area. And he was above all this stuff. What he would do is he'd go in and he'd quiz they'd hear that Lord Rothschild was coming to inspect their research facility. Everyone would run around wetting themselves that the great Lord was coming, and he would then interrogate the scientists. I interviewed plenty of them, one in particular, a great Mark Oliphant, Sir Marcus Oliphant, who invented radar and was also big in nuclear physics as well, and the bomb. And he interviewed him, and of course they spilled everything because the great Lord was wanting to know what was going on in the lab or what was this equipment for. And he nicked a bit of equipment actually from Oliphant. That's another story. And then sent it back after he'd sent the copy of it off to the Russians. But that was his job. So he got inside. He knew all the research. He was able to push it all over to the Russians, and he would give it to Blunt. And this is during the war, or Burgess. They were the two main recipients of it. They would meet their control, their KGB control, who would be in or usually inside the embassy, the Russian embassy, the Soviet embassy, and they would send it off in a diplomatic bag to Moscow. So the Russians were right up with everything that the Brits were doing on all these areas of research.
Because the bomb was surely, most of that was all being done over in the States. It wasn't all of that technology. No.
Enormous amount being done in Britain. Don't ever kid yourself that you weren't at the forefront. The British were at the forefront of that area. Yes, the Americans got it off the ground first, but they weren't the leaders. They didn't have the leading scientists that you did en masse working on it. So it was a combination of stuff. They were working together. Rothschild was one of the conduits for that at one point, passing information to the Americans. So it was you were equally proficient at developing the bomb, if not better, if not better. And I could go. There's a book in it, but I'm not bothering about it. There's no doubt you were big. So if they stole from you in certain areas and passed it to the Russians, that was just as good as getting it, because the Americans were giving. There was no suspicion about the Brits having major spies within their organisation in the establishment at that point in World War II. There was after World War II when the defection. Obviously, the Brits are flying off to Moscow. Oh, I'm out of here. I'm a double agent. The Americans are going, what? I knew that guy. You know, I knew him. I trained him. I was with him. But they were very, very upset about the British after the war, in the Cold War. But during the war, we were passing, and I say the royal we, the British were passing on all their information on the bomb to the Brits. And a lot of it, I would say the British had a bigger impact on the development of the bomb than the Americans, if you part it down.
Okay, so that's obviously quite important secrets being passed on to the Russians. Very important role he's taking. Do you think it's feasible that the Russians were as well versed as the Americans? And where was Rothschild's, Victor Rothschild's loyalty? Was it to Moscow or was it to Churchill?
What a good and interesting question, which I had to delve into. He was close to Winston. He was an advisor to Winston. There's been denials on this. It's absolutely 100%. Because he was a lord and he was respected and he had all the right degrees and everything. He was right up there in the wealth of the family, the banking family. So,
well, I can remember reading, I mean, there shouldn't be any denials, that there are a whole series of entries of Winston Churchill in the 1920s, at the Tring and the Waddesdon estates, Rothschild estates, that Churchill was in and out there the whole time.
Yeah, well, that was a young Rothschild was too young at that point, but he would have been aware and introduced and would have known, and Churchill would have watched his development and been connected. There's no doubt about that. They were an incredibly powerful family and a wealthy family, and they are even triple that. Quadruple it today. I mean, the fourth Baron is probably the richest man next to Vladimir Putin in the world.
Okay. Look at the Cold War, World War II, I think we ought to just take a look back at the sorts of young men they were, these Cambridge spies, at Cambridge itself, because you can kind of see, can't you, young, hothead, young men, thinking, well, actually, this country is really unequal. It's very unfair. We want a better world where they were looking to Marxism. They were looking to communism to really turn upside down the class system in Britain. And you can see that might actually really motivate people.
Well, you had two factors with it that you've just named. No question they were ideologues. And easy, ripe pickings for the KGB. Yeah, we've got the system, boys. We've got it. We're equal. Everyone in Russia is doing well. You haven't seen it, but it's happening. Believe us. And they all fell for it, hook, line, sinker, because it represented, let's change England. Let's change the UK. Let's do it. I mean, for far too long, this arcane system has controlled us. Let's do it. You can see it. Now, Rothschild had a double whammy because he was a Jew. And the Nazis made an example of the Rothschilds everywhere they went. They stole their art. They butchered them. They did terrible things to the family. So he had a double whammy for wanting Moscow, the Russians, to be involved in any coming conflagration. And, of course, everyone knew in the 30s, you didn't have to be Churchill, that there's going to be something happen, because the way that this little tin pot dictator, Hitler, was marauding around, there was no question it was going to happen. So he went, and it's fair, and it is very fair to say, he did it for the sake of his family and also of the UK to save the West by bringing the Russians in to smash the Nazis from one direction while the Allied forces came in the other. And he did a very good job in that respect. You have to admire him on that level. I do. The problem was that he did went further than spying before and during the war, and continued on in his own way for his own reasons after the war.
Okay, so, so we're in a very different situation after the war. If you're cooperating with the Russians during the war, that's one thing. That's okay. You might even get a pat on the back for that from some parts of the establishment. But so, as soon as the Cold War starts, I mean, surely this is, it's got to be discontinued. But they didn't, of course. They carried on supporting...
Well, they were caught. Look at them. I mean, you're Philby, and your father's a famous figure, an Arabist in the Middle East, and he's been a big figure, and if he's caught, it's a terrible moment for everyone in their family and his family. He didn't want to be outed, so he's stuck. Burgess is gay, so he would have been in jail straight away, whether he was a spy or not. And you've got Philby, Burgess McLean. McLean was bisexual. Whenever he was under stress, when he was in Cairo, he would go into the, you know, look for distractions, pedophilic distractions. So he was going to be nobbled as well. And then you've got Blunt, who was an out-and-out gay who used to pick up trade everywhere in Hyde Park. I mean, there were about 10 citations or 10 moments I found in the research where judges had dismissed police dragging him into court and saying, well, you know, he's got to go free because he's with the royals. It was never public, but it happened. So he was also in trouble for two counts. That was his homosexuality and also his spying. They were caught. They had to do what the Russians wanted. Now, some of them stood up. Blunt was indignant about it, but he had to do it. So what he did, he was very clever. He said, I'm going to be the king's art curator. Therefore, I'm going to learn much more about everything going on because I'm close to the king. Now, they had a very dumb double agent running him, or an agent running him. Milos Sorov, who was a thug and a bit of a bully and didn't know how to handle Blunt, of course, because he was an upper-class Englishman, and he fell for it and let him go to the palace. Now, he did have influence by being at the palace, but nothing like being inside MI5. So Blunt won that round, but he kept on spying, and what he did was he acted as a conduit for people like Rothschild who were passing information on. He would be the one that would run to the embassy or meet the major spies, Barkovsky being one, who was inside Vladimir Barkovsky, who was inside the Russian embassy, the Soviet embassy. So he kept on spying and passing information. They were caught, Tony. You know, you've got to get your head back in that time. They didn't want to be outed as spies, so they kept on spying.
But surely Anthony Blunt, I mean, wasn't it the 1970s or 80s before he was caught? He was going for a good 20, 25 years.
And that's why the Crown, that television series at the moment, Crown, have you seen it?
No.
It's feeble in parts. It's got a few basic points. It's basically an argument for the Republic in England, I would say, the way they've hammered Charles in it. Made him look not a very nice character. The rest of them get off lightly. It's a drama about the royals. I don't buy it. I think it's feeble in areas that I know, particularly the espionage ones. But where were we on that question? Sorry.
Blunt,
you know, he was embedded, and the point was MI5, I'm getting back to the facts about what happened, not what they put in the drama. The facts were that MI5 said to the royals, well, better if he's on the inside of the tent, if you like, than outside. Because if you expose him and put him in jail, it's a can of worms. The government, of course, would have been discombobulated and upset by it if he'd been nobbled and outed. So they kept him inside the tent. And the current queen knew about him from at least, and probably before, but let's say at least 1951, before she was queen. She was still princess. Now, the reason I know that is a courtier has said that at one point, when they were walking along one of the places in Buckingham Palace, she turned to her equerry and said, there goes our Russian spy. Now, at that point, he was being interrogated because of his links to Burgess, Philby and McLean. As was Rothschild, by the way. He was interrogated 11 times over a decade. 11 times. They pulled him back in for a chat. So the Queen knew at least something was going on. Of course, when the defections occurred, she realised there could be a problem with Blunt, but they kept him on the inside in a very British way, swept it under the carpet. I've discovered a lot of things that they've done that way, but it hung around for a long, long time until 1970. 1989, a little early, when the book a book was published about him and outed him as a spy. I mean, it was fictitious names, but everyone knew that it was Philby. So the pressure was on in – sorry, not Philby, Blunt. So the pressure was on in Parliament, and Thatcher, not happy that she'd been kept in the dark, not told about this sweeping under the carpet. Admittedly, it was 20 years earlier that it all happened, or what, 63 to 79, 16 years. So she went full bore and outed Blunt in Parliament, and he had to – got a terrible – terrible thing happened. He had to give back his knighthood. Got a slap on the.
It's interesting that Victor Rothschild was being questioned at the same time. How did he manage to keep the whole thing under wraps? Because it really didn't come out, any of this, until he died around about, I think it was 1990.
Yeah, well, it was coming out a bit, because Thatcher had to get up in Parliament and say, quote, "We have no evidence that Lord Rothschild is a Russian spy." She put it in the present tense. Now, that was the coldest, most unlikely confirmation of anything. I mean, she was saying, "We're sniffy about him." And he was finished by that part. That was about 1980, about 86, I think, if my memory was correct on that. And, of course, it came out more of his activities came out in the Spycatcher trial.
That's right. Interesting, isn't it? I mean, this is that era, isn't it? The mid-80s, Spycatcher, yeah. And Peter Wright, too.
Well, they pushed this on to Roger Hollis. They said Roger Hollis was a major spy. They never mentioned the fifth man, but everyone was thinking, oh, this is the big fish, we've got him. And he was long dead, so he was attacked. He was dead, I think, in 73.
This is the ex-director general of MI5, isn't it, Roger Hollis?
That's correct. And they were trying to say that it was him. And you might remember that... Spycatcher Peter, what's his name? Peter Wright wrote a book about it. It had been written about before with different names being mentioned and so forth, but he came out and said it was definitely Roger Hollis. Now, that was bollocks, and everyone knew it. Look, I had good contacts in MI6 at that point, and they were telling me categorically it wasn't. There's no way that it was Hollis. But it was useful for Rothschild to pin it on Hollis, because that took the pressure off him being investigated further in the 80s. You know, Peter Wright was helped enormously by Rothschild to get out of England and go as far away as he could to a distant land called Australia, and even a more distant island called Tasmania, to breed horses and be happy, right? Well, he was a very disgruntled operative, because he had been, he'd been trying to push for someone. He knew the Russians were getting all their spying activities. He knew the Russians were being passed stuff, and he didn't know who it was. And it wasn't his boss, Hollis. It was his great mate, Victor Rothschild. And he did a brilliant thing. He and Tess Rothschild were brilliant. Wright was a new boy who loved, you know, all the newfangled equipment and the listening equipment. He was very good on bugs and bugging. He was very good on the biological weaponry, all that stuff. And he was a bit like Rothschild. He was a polymath. He was a pretty smart fellow, right? But he was from the middle, lower classes, and he was in MI5, and they were a bit snotty about this bloke who took his spying very, very seriously. And Rothschild was the one that said, "Hey, old chap, look, come round to our place for dinner and tell us your problems." I'm paraphrasing, of course. And he and the charming, beautiful Tess, the wife, used to get everything they wanted out of him by looking after him and giving, and he felt, oh, my good mate, Lord Rothschild, I can tell him anything, and he's got more power than these twits that I'm working with.
Oh, dear, so they basically schmoozed him for all of the secret stuff.
It's a brilliant, brilliant operation, absolutely brilliant. And no one is – I'm the only clown who's picked this up, because I've just done more homework, that's all. But, and also it helps, to be fair, Tony, being in Oz and knowing the British terrain fairly well and having lived there 12 years and knowing all the – having a good contact within the intelligence world, I don't have the same attitude. I mean, say if a Brit came here and said, you know, Don Bradman was a spy or something, well, everyone would go, oh, how can you say Don Bradman was a spy for the Russians, you know? I'm not saying yes, I'm just saying that no Australian would dare say it, but a Brit might say, well, he might be an icon for you, but in fact, we don't like him because he spied for the Russians. By the way, anyone listening, Don Bradman, I'm his biographer, he was not a Russian spy.
Okay, so
he spilled his guts, and then they had to pin it on someone, and it was Hollis that they pinned it on. He was long dead, and Rothschild was the key player in manipulating that.
There was no question
about it. He was the key player, and then they had the trial because
there was a big court case around Spycatcher, wasn't there? I remember the one line I remember from Spycatcher. There's obviously far more to it than that. The one about bugging and burgling their way around London. And, of course, you know, being involved in the bugging and burgling of the Labour Party in the 1970s under Wilson.
Yeah, well, that all happened. But the one thing that happened in that spy trial, it was fascinating for me because I was on the inside. I was published by the same publisher as Wright and got to know him and his manager and was able to interrogate and get what I wanted behind the scenes. I had the same publisher, was published at the same time with another book, and it was the luck of the draw, Tony, because here I was leaving England to go back to Australia in 85, and I thought, well, that's the end of my investigation into who the fifth man was. I've got no hope of doing that. I'm going to be isolated down in Melbourne doing other books. But then, lo and behold, old Peter Wright comes into the picture. I had access. I had a deal of information. I was well back in the pack, I have to say, in terms of outing whoever the major spies were. But I got right into the front of the pack by being there. And I wasn't afraid to go to Russia and interrogate them as much as I could. But let me tell you about that trial, because Thatcher was hammered for that. She protected Hollis and said, well, he didn't spy, and we're not going to let you bring a book out, apart from the fact that you're breaking the Official Secrets Act. He did not spy. Now, that was correct. So what happened was Malcolm Turnbull puffed his chest out and made himself famous and made a huge error, but it didn't matter because Thatcher and company had one arm tied behind their back during the trial, and Malcolm Turnbull got his information from Chapman Pincher, known as the Pissoir of Fleet Street, because everyone leaked information to him, and he was in Rothschild's pocket. He had helped Peter Wright get established in Tasmania, and Rothschild was behind him, the Eminence Grise. And it came out during the trial that Rothschild was involved, and that more information poured out about that then. But Turnbull won the case on a terribly wrong premise, and that was simply this, that Thatcher had told Rothschild cover up everything, and he had nothing. The Thatcher did not use Rothschild. Rothschild used himself to cover up everything about him, basically, and pinned it on Hollis, the dead Inspector General. So that's the truth of it. That's the integrity of it. It'll come out. Look, these things, Tony, believe me, I've been in the game half a century. These things take decades. My outing of Rothschild, the book came out in 93. In 2016 and 17, information was leaked about Rothschild being a major Russian spy, a KGB spy, and I got hold of that material, and I'm going to have it in an update in an anthology I'm doing on all my work. I'm not going to have an update of the book. I could do it, but it's enough in it, as far as I'm concerned, as evidence against Rothschild. But having the KGB verify it, inadvertently, if you want me to talk about that, I can, but I've definitely got the information. I was 100% certain about what I did because the work and the contacts I had. It wasn't a popular view because I'm outing another. I mean, Blunt had been outed in.
Well, you're outing one of the top pillars of the British establishment. It's never going to be a popular thing. But look, I must put to you, because Yuri Modin, who was the control of the spies, I mean, he was at the Russian embassy working for the KGB. Apparently, he has denied any of this. He said he didn't even say these things. Isn't his name Yuri Modin?
Yuri Ivanovich Modin.
He's denied it, apparently. He said he didn't tell you these things.
Oh, that's total rubbish. Where did you pick that up?
Is it in a French translation or something?
No, that's you've got a little bit of skew. This is a very difficult topic. I'm not being patronising. It's a difficult topic. What happened was Modin, I was interviewing him huge amounts, 3 weeks on end, daily for 8 hours in his apartment in Russia with Jack Grossman, who was with me filming it all. And Modin wrote a book for a French company, Lafon, Robert Lafon, happened to be one of my publishers as well. Now, Lafon, Robert Lafon published his book, which was called My Friends of Cambridge, My Comrades of Cambridge, right? That's a different headline than the company called headline in the UK. It's a bland rendition of his activity, Moden's activity as a KGB agent. So it was big in France because they wanted to, you know, say nasty things about the Brits, which they love to do, the French. And so they published it. It's bland and boring and there's nothing in it. So what the buyers of the rights in England called Headline did, they made it a headline and said, oh, Cairncross has been named. Now, I can tell you 100% because I rang. So in other words, they were saying it wasn't, they didn't mention Rothschild. They just said Cairncross is the fifth man. And they had, there was another heading for it in the headline thing was totally misleading. And they changed about 10 lines in the story to say that Moden had said it was a guy called John Cairncross, who was a spy. I talked about him more than anyone else, if you recall, in the fifth man. I opened the book with him because I wanted to show he had nothing to do with that Cambridge ring. He was a spy for the Russians. He didn't know any of the spies. He was hardly in a ring. You know, you go down to the pub with a group of mates, you know who each one is. If the guy goes to another pub in Glasgow, you don't know him, right? So this John Cairncross, a spy for the Russians, had nothing to do with the Cambridge ring. So it was a lovely concoction by the headline company in England, a total fraud on the public. And I'm not the only one. Robert Norton Taylor, Richard Norton Taylor, isn't it, from The Guardian? And also a guy called Rushbridger from The Guardian rang Moden and got him. He was fuming, and he was fuming when I rang and said, what are you saying in this English book that Cairncross was a spy? He denied it all to us. So that's on the record in The Guardian, my record of it. And there was another filmmaker from a British company who went over, and I don't think he interviewed him, but at least he interviewed him on the phone, and he denied it was Cairncross. So that's utterly debunked. And if Headline wants to take me to court over it, let them come and make a complete idiot.
Well, what about, I mean, because obviously, you know, he's a very major figure, Victor Rothschild, in the Jewish community in the UK. Yeah. I mean, you could be accused of anti-Semitism, blaming him for being a major spy, a major mover and shaker, and basically selling out the country.
Yeah, there was a bit of that on the fringe when it came out here and in Australia. A bit of a laugh when I've got a Jewish grandmother, but that's beside the point. When I came back from Russia, I remember talking to Jack Grossman, I mentioned him before, who's Jewish, of course, he's now gone. And I said to Jack, look, I've got to tell you, it's Victor Nathaniel Mayer Rothschild of the Rothschild family. And he looked at me and said, you've got to go for it. You know, he was red. And people out there saying, oh, well, why didn't he go on his own evidence? Why does he have to tell his best mate who was a Jew about it? I wanted to hear it from Jack, who I respected enormously, that it was okay to go for it. I was sensitive enough to understand what it would mean to out Rothschild as a major spy. And I have no doubts on the information I got from the Russians and also MI6 and others. And, yeah, there was a bit of anti-Semitism. There was anti-Semitism within the Russians themselves in terms of Rothschild. They didn't like him. The head, Moden's boss, was a guy called Ivan the Terrible Serov, right? The Terrible, inverted commas. He hated Rothschild but realised what a terrific spy he was for them, and that's where the confirmation evidence came from, his hidden diaries, which were released a few years ago, just recently, and I got hold of and was able to use. And MI6 had as well. Everyone had them. It hasn't been much. There hasn't been much public activity on it. If you look up on the net, you'll probably find something on Ivan Serov's declarations in his diaries. But he was a brute. He was Stalin's henchman, and he didn't like Rothschild because Rothschild was a very, it goes without saying, a brilliant mind, a Jew, and he was very independent. Even though the KGB thought they had him, he was a very, very independent.
So, I mean, this is where I'm coming to now. I mean, he was looking for something back, wasn't he, for all this help that he gave the Soviets right the way through the Second World War and afterwards. Now, this whole episode spans, and Victor Rothschild's life spans the creation of the State of Israel. Do you think he had a role in that?
Huge. Number one. He got the Russians to vote for the development of the State of Israel. Australia did. We had a good affinity with the Israelis, and we backed it. But if you look at the roll call, the United Nations had stood up and said, we want Israel developed and so forth in 1948, this was. Australia was in, Russia was in, and that was Rothschild's payback. He just told Stalin, you have to do it effectively because we've done so much for you, you do it. And, you know, it was tied up in the anti-Nazi thing, they'll be able to use all that. So you know, Victor began, created their entire intelligence network. I have that in the book, but that's absolutely correct. They're beholden to him for that. And
so didn't they have something called the Haganah before? It was during World War II, and then that was turned into the Mossad in 1948. Well, probably a few years after 1948.
Yeah, they're pretty effective. They've just killed that Iranian, I would say. I don't know, but it looks like they murdered those, killed two of them now who are developing nuclear weapons. I mean, all the blocks about the Iranians not developing nuclear weapons and the stupid deal that Obama and company did, absolutely ridiculous.
Okay, that's a biggie. You know, most people seem to say that the Iranians don't have nukes, but the Israelis do.
Of course they do. Of course they do. Israelis have them. I mean, but the Iranians have them on. They're building them all. They haven't stopped. It's total rubbish. Look, the Mossad wouldn't worry about bumping anyone off if there was nothing happening. But that's beside the point. We're talking about Rothschild. He started that network, intelligence network, and that was part of the deal that he would set that up, and he did, and it's been very effective. Just as a sidelight, my good mate Jack fought for the British in the Middle East, and then when the fight for Israel had been developed, he joined the Haganah. So he was fighting against the Brits, effectively. He's no one more British than good old Jack, but he did have the dual operation there. He went over and fought again in the Middle East, this time against the British to help set up the State of Israel. And the Brits didn't want Israel for one particular reason. They weren't anti-Semitic. That's ridiculous. They wanted it because they had such terrific contacts in the Middle East and setups in Saudi, Lebanon, everywhere, Syria from World War One. They did not want a rogue state implanted into the middle of the Middle East that they had no control of. And that's why they were very much against the development of Israel.
No, I mean, I wonder because certainly the United States and Britain, mainly the US, who were the first to recognize the State of Israel, and today, of course, there's something like $30 billion a year shoveled towards Israel from the US. Now, when all this US Israeli cooperation started, around about the time of the Six-Day War, I think, it was probably going on before that, but it became massive. Obviously, the Americans came over in the October War in the 70s with loads and loads of military equipment to back up the Israelis. I mean, this is still that during the Cold War. Surely the Russians at that point are saying, well, you know, we want nothing to do with these Israelis. They're our enemy.
Well, they were. They were easing out of it because Stalin was long dead and his henchmen were long out of it. So they had no reason to support Israel. But don't forget, Rothschild was still there. Victor Nathaniel Mayer would have been saying, we believe the state should be upheld. And he would have been doing that quietly on the side. It wasn't a major event for him after Israel, but he definitely had some influence. But yeah, of course, and the Americans have, because of the very powerful Jewish community, have kept that state running. It's interesting at the moment, though, whether they've pulled off a coup or not with all those other states supporting Israel and becoming friends, quote-unquote. Very interesting time, actually. All the other peace accords have fallen apart, and we don't know what will happen under Biden if he is actually elected, because he is in the pocket of so many people, particularly the Chinese. So it's a much bigger picture.
Well, before we leave Israel, I'll ask you to look in your crystal ball and tell us what you think may be happening over there. Because, as you said, many of these Gulf states, which have been quietly negotiating and very friendly with the United States and the West generally, are now openly siding with the Israelis against Arab states like Syria, etc.
Yeah, well, I think with good reason. And Syria, under Erdogan, is a very dangerous state.
You mean Assad?
No, I mean Turkey.
Ah, right, you mean Turkey. Right, okay, can you say that again?
You have to know the history. And the history was that it was liberated – Syria was liberated in 1918, and I know this because I've written a book on it. 100 years later, the Turks want the Middle East back. They want it back. So watch this space. They've already got a foothold in Syria at the moment, and they are determined to take it back. It's only 100 years. It's a very short time in history. They controlled, you know, they were a huge empire in Europe. They had that taken away, and then the last bastion was the Middle East.
So this is the, hang on, this is the Ottoman Empire you're talking about.
Yeah,
so
of course, and they want it back. Just watch what's happening. So there's going to be a very interesting development there with all the Arab states lining up to support Israel at this moment, whether the Turks will then say, well, wait a minute, we don't agree with this, we're going to go in there. So it'll be a different kind of confrontation from the past, because the Turks are so aggressive and want it back. It's a simple thing. It's only 100 years. They were utterly humiliated by having that area taken from them in the Middle East War, in World War One. Utterly humiliated. Terrible moment. Ataturk pulled them around and, made it an interesting development as a republic. That's all over now. The Muslims have more control and they will want the Middle East back. That's my
point. Well, they're already sitting there, aren't they, in northern Syria, you know, getting revving the tanks up, I guess.
Yeah.
And let's get back to Viktor Rothschild again, though, because he did also play a very important role behind the scenes in politics, including things like having a role in appointments of the director generals of MI5 and MI6.
Yeah, he had enormous weight, because what people would do, and I don't have this chapter and verse, but I know that this sort of thing happened. People would go to Viktor, not knowing, of course, about even when he was challenged by MI5 and interrogated. It was interrogations, the word, but in fact, they were asking him what he knew about Burgess and Shelby and McLean and all the rest of them. He wasn't actually pinned down as a spy himself. They suspected something, but they thought, no, it can't be because he's Lord Rothschild. So people would come to him and say, well, do you think that Joe Bloggs or Jenny Bloggs should be MI5 director? And what do you think about the Inspector General? Should it be this one or that one? And he'd say, yeah, he's a good chap. We should have him. He would be contacted more than anyone else. Why? Because he's on the inside during World War II in MI5. And was connected. There's no one bigger in your history, your recent history, certainly in the 20th century, than Victor Nathaniel Mayer Rothschild in terms of his influence.
So he was officially or unofficially head of vetting everything.
Yeah, he was, because look at the prime ministers. Even the very bright Thatcher did not know, was not informed that there was a deal done to keep Blunt in the tent with the royals. She wasn't told. It was a shock. Because MI5 were rulers, as they call themselves, of the universe. In other words, when there's a continuity of government for 30 years, that's different. But when you've got the civil service running things, because a change of government, Labour, Conservative, Labour, blah, 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 you go on forever, the monarch stays in the same position, you have the situation where there are stabilities like Rothschild. He's gone to. He has the influence. How would someone like Wilson, even Wilson, Heath, they don't know what's happened inside intelligence. They don't know anything. They have to be told who by MI5 and MI6. So they're the ones who do the bidding. I mean, yes, Minister is the most brilliant portrayal of what actually occurs in British government or government anywhere with the civil service.
Let's maybe just revisit Blunt, if you can remember, and you know, what about this interesting little visit at the end of the Second World War to grab, probably just for destruction and burning, the correspondence between the British and the German royal family before the First World War. Do you know much about that?
Yes, I do. I think I'm part of a Channel 4 documentary coming up in your country, so that'll be, I've given chapter and verse there. It's fascinating because here I am, I'm in front of Modin, the most knowledgeable and key ex-spy, and I said to him, I got straight on to whether or not King Edward VIII had been in Hitler's pocket. I went straight to him and said, what is your information on that? What have you got on that? And is that in the royal letters? Now, what happened was Blunt was sent to Germany and to get back all the royal correspondence. Now, there were two reasons for this. Not the one that's the one that's more public is about the worry about Edward VIII being in Hitler's pocket and the correspondence between Nazis within, you know, during the war and King Edward VIII. Not so much Hitler, although he went and met Hitler, as we all know. He saw, I think he did the Nazi salute, silly old Edward. It was a stupid thing to do. But anyway, he did the wrong thing, and he was nearly in trouble. He hated the idea of communism taking over. He had in mind that the Tsar's family was obliterated, and he feared that would happen.
Well, he ended up marrying a Nazi agent.
Well, I don't know that. I don't know
Mrs. Simpson.
Yeah, but she wasn't a Nazi, and she was used by the Nazis like he was. I don't think she was particularly in the setup beforehand. I don't think that's true, but it's too much. There's too much argy-bargy there to say that. But she definitely was involved in ingratiating herself, as he was, with the Germans. Oddly enough, it's not the major thing that the KGB were onto, and this people have to put their heads back to that time. It's just after the war. You've been belted. You've had, you know, you've had the blitz on Britain. You've had all your soldiers dying and everyone absolutely fatigued from war. And had anything come up that was damaging to the royals on a big scale, you might well, with a Labour government, have gone to a republic. It was a chance. There's no question about it at that point. I'm not making a comment either way. In fact, I'm quite ambivalent about the royals in this country. It's another thing. But they had this massive correspondence in this castle, secreted away in Germany, from primarily from Victoria to her daughter Vicky. Now, again, please don't put your heads in this period. It's 1945. It's a different era. What King George the Sixth, the Queen's father, was worried about was, as much as Edward VIII's link to the Nazis, which was genuine, there's no question he would have been Prince Regent, he would have been king if the Germans had taken over. I have no doubt about that. You don't have to do much research to realise that. But the correspondence they were more worried about in 1945 was Victoria opening up about her life to her daughter, which was much different from the public dissemination of it in dramas that are endlessly on television. By the way, I think the British drama is the best in the world, but it is total fiction about Victoria. It's total fiction. I've done a book on partly on this. She was much more interesting as the real queen, the real person, but she divulged her life. And what the we don't have to go into that here, but what about her lover and so forth, not Johnny Brown or not even Abdul Karim, the fourth one. There was someone else before, let me reiterate, before Albert. There was someone else before Albert, which I've written about. But
so, I mean, didn't she have some kind of secret lover that came up to Balmoral?
No, she didn't. She was the lover of, and I've made this public, it's been a big sell in Australia. I haven't even tried to sell it with you people yet, and I will do that. It's a matter of getting around to the stuff and agents and all the rest of it. But no, she had the captain of the Horse Guards was the 13th Lord Elphinstone, right? A real true blood Scot. In other words, he goes back to about 300 or 400 years in terms of the breeding and money and all the rest of it. And he was captain of the Horse Guards. He was 28. She was 15. He was 27, 28. And she made the approach to him. And they had a ripping affair. And he was then, when they found out about it, he was pushed off to be president, it was called, of Madras for 5 years. She pined for him. It's a much different story. Little Prince Albert, who she met only once, note, don't watch all the drivel in the dramas, only once. He fell asleep at the table. He was 16, and he fell asleep with his head not in the soup but next to it. And she made a wonderful comment. She said he is not very worldly or something like that, meaning he was a virgin. And she had been having a ripping affair. Now, the age of consent was 14 in those days, so everyone shock horror. It was 14. It was 1886. It was lifted up to 16. But people say, oh, but Kensington Palace was a prison for her. Yes, it was. But every day, every single day, she went riding with the captain of the Horse Guards. Now, they didn't want him. Do you know why they didn't want him? Come on. Why did the royal court not want this high-bred Scot who, was a bit of a dasher, a brilliant guy? He ended up doing a tremendous job during the British uprising, the Indian uprising in 1857. was sent over. He went over in his own volition and really can't, he was the key player.
So what, did he have syphilis?
No. Oh, you're a terrible person to say that. No. No, that's a good answer though. It's a lateral thinking answer. Sounds like you've got a Seinfeldian mind there, dirty mind. I love it. No. What was the court made up of? They've heard Germans, Tony. Germans, and here was a heathen from north of the border, much better bred, much better, much more lucrative, if you like, than this little princeling nobody from Germany. She wanted him. She wanted the tough Scot. I mean, he wasn't tough. He was just a tough.
I mean, wasn't she in a position to have both?
No. Oh, yes, she was. Yeah, have both. That's good. A bit like the King of Thailand. Oh, I didn't say that.
Well, a bit like Charles and Camilla and Diana.
They can. The royals can. Why can they do it? Because they can. But no, that wasn't the case. He had little Prince Charming, Alfred, had not appeared on the scene at that point. He was back in Germany pining for some princess somewhere. There were a small pool of princesses around the world. He's looking around, where can I land myself with my wonderful bloodline in my piddly little German background? No, the German court, they were all Germans dominating the court, right? Her parents were German, blah, blah, blah. The only one who wasn't was Lord Melbourne, who was doing the German court's bidding, and he was the one that got Rothschild, I'm going back badly there, that got Elphinstone out of the scene. Now, there were rumours that the first child was his, but I'm not going to go into that. It's a long story. I did do a lot of research on it. But anyway, the point is that, and he was, by the way, she got him back into the court after he'd had his servitude, if you like, because it was like being sent to Australia then, to be sent to Madras. Even though you are the president and the top dog in the Raj, you are still out of the picture.
Okay, so this is what that correspondence was about, yeah?
That's what that correspondence, exactly. Now, what I find amusing, and I don't want 1,000 researchers going in and usurping my work, but it's all laid out in one of your libraries there. I'm not even going to tell you which one, because I don't want, you'll have a 1,000 wannabes now going have a look. What amuses me mostly is all those pompous skits that get on television, the royal correspondents and the royal historians, never ever went near this archive. It's the biggest archive in a particular part of your system. I went in there for 6 months. The librarian there said to me, I said to her, how long is it going to take to learn about Elphinstone? She said, well, there are 303 files, Professor. It'll take you 6 years. I said, well, I've got 6 months. I'll have a crack. It's not easy. It's difficult to get in. They vet you, even though it's allegedly a public library. But once you're in, you get all this correspondence, and it's just there. It's just the whole thing's there. Look, I found when I did the research on it, Hobart had a paper called the Tasmanian Examiner. I think it's still in existence. It's the same thing. 1838. Talking about, and this is, I'm just saying the outside, the Times had all these stories. You've got to go and do your homework. Talking about her relationship with Elphinstone.
Yeah, but hang on. I mean, what's the point of Blunt going over there to get all these letters and burn them?
It's a long and tiring interview, Tony. You haven't put your head back to 1945. So to have the double whammy of Victoria's secret life coming out, it's only 40 years since he died. It's not a long time. Yeah. She's the great pillar of the establishment. That's why I said put your head back. Don't think about it now. It's a nothing event for us now. But for the Russians, oh, we've got all this correspondence from Queen Victoria. Oh, we've got this stuff on Edward VIII. We've got them. We've got them by the short and curlies. We can blackmail the royals. And I did ask Modin that on camera. And in fact, I think that Channel 4 have taken that material. I'm pretty sure I sent it over to them, and they'll have it in the documentary. And he goes, oh, yes, we could have. He had a sort of a sing-song voice like a Swede. He looks like Colonel Sanders, by the way. He's got the wispy white beard, the whole thing. And I said, could you have blackmailed the royals? And he says, oh, yes, of course we could. He said, but we would not do that. He's not going to admit that they could do it. But, of course, they had it over them for whatever purpose. But keeping Blunt in the tent was very useful for both the Russians and MI6. You know, it's very interesting stuff, really. But anyway, there was a point you brought up about, and I was going to leap in with something absolutely wonderful, but I can't remember what it was now.
Okay, well, I think we should be winding up. As you said, we've been over an hour now, but
it's impossible
to talk to an Australian journalist without mentioning Julian Assange, really, because of the way that, I mean, he's actually leaked some of the most incredible stuff over the last 15 years or so. And now he's facing extradition to the US. He's contemplating, not contemplating, he's preparing to commit suicide. I wonder what, you know, you as a journalist and as an Australian make of this whole debacle.
Yeah, well, I come from Melbourne. I'm Melbourne right now, not far from where he was born and raised, and was a member of some very odd setups. But Julian has committed those problems under their Espionage Act. I think, this is what I think, if Biden wins, and it looks like he will now, it's got to be ratified by the, it'll be ratified by the courts, effectively, his victory. I think he will be sent back and probably executed. I think he probably will be executed. I don't think that Trump, I think Trump would have had a chance to say, nah, we're not going to execute him. And that
was Trump actually offered, didn't he? He said, well, okay, we'll drop the charges if he admits to having done espionage. Yeah. Well, he's saying he himself has not done any espionage. He's been basically receiving material, as any publisher or journalist does, from leakers, possibly from people who've been spying in one sort or another, but that it's all legit. And he's basically a publisher journalist, not a spy.
Yeah, that's a lot of argument with respect, with great respect to you, Tony. I can see you're a very bright researcher yourself. No, it doesn't wash. You know what you're doing. He was naive to a degree, but he got in very deep. He was suddenly flooded with people who wanted to release things. So he was cognizant of what he was releasing. It made him a party. It's like saying, well, Rothschild after the war passed information to Blunt, but he didn't actually hand it to the KGB. It wasn't Rothschild. Oh, sorry. Well, not good enough. Assange had information passed. He knew what he was doing. I don't think he should be executed. I think he should be wrapped on the knuckles, given, you know, a custodial sentence of some sort, something tiny. It's not a big deal, but they're making a big deal out of it. Now, it depends. You see, Hillary will have enormous impact with Biden back in. She'll want Assange dead. He had too much on Hillary Clinton, and she'll want him dead. And the only one of the reasons that Trump would have protected him was that he would have been getting up the nose of Hillary Clinton and saying, well, no, we're not going to let you get away with that. He's going to live, and he's going to talk about what you were doing. So, you know, I think his last chance will be Trump. It's about a 10% chance at the moment that Trump will actually get in for a second term. It's not over yet, folks.
Really? You think not? You think it's possible Trump might be in?
Well, don't look at the media. All your media. I mean, I know I'm getting information from the inside. And by the way, just to put my neutral position on this, I was absolutely hammered by the Republicans when I had a book come out on the presidency 30 years ago. And you might say, oh, well, that's too long. They're all in major positions of power now. Some of them retired, but they still hate me for the book I brought out, which they were so paranoid about it. It was only really talking about the way Reagan was elected, the mechanics of it, rather than anything devastating. The book sold very well in the States, but it didn't have anything absolutely devastating, but they still hate me. The Democrats loved me because I was, you know, I was bringing out a book that was positive about their position. That's 30 years ago. Now, so I'm in a neutral position. When I say the Republicans hated me, when I did a 20-city tour of the country, they sent two people to harass me every time I appeared in the lobby of a hotel. They'd ring me up in the middle of the night. They'd put pressure on me. You have right of reply when you do interviews, or you did then, on television, and they would come on after I'd been on and say, oh, he's an Australian git and he writes fiction and it's all rubbish and it's not true. And I had to wear that because it was part of the electoral system. You had to have a balanced commentary. And they'd say, oh, he's an Australian, what would he know, blah, blah, blah. And so I went through it there. I said, look, it didn't damage me in any way. I just thought, well, that's interesting. That's a real power base there. You know what you're doing when you attack somebody, or it looks like an attack. So I've kept my hand in just in interest sake, not with the contacts I have, with what's happening there. I'm still getting information, which is very solid. And the Republicans, no, they're just as bad as they ever was. But Trump is a different kettle of fish, and I'm watching that very closely. There's a 10% chance right now because of the legal activity. Do not watch the media on, or do watch it, but don't take it. They're all hammering Trump. It's a lovely cover for what's actually happening. I mean, I'm sure he doesn't mind. I'm sure he's wounded, by the way, by losing. But there's a lot more going on in the courts than you're getting displayed. The thing is, the key is whether it goes finally up to the Supreme Court. And who has power 6-3 over that? The Republicans. Right? So if it gets there and it's a decision on whether there's been, they're going to aim at the Constitution. If there's been a breach of the Constitution on a large scale, all the fraud stuff is not that difficult to prove, but, you know, all the double counting and all that, that's not the major issue the Republicans are going for or Trump's team is going for. It is the Constitution, because the court will be obligated, if it gets to the High Court, to say, sorry, you all broke the rules, no swing straights, you're all Democrats, the votes are going to Donald J. Trump. Now, that's the only avenue they've got. It is not out of the woods. When you see something leaking up, getting up to the High Court, they don't care that they're being rejected in the lower courts. It's like going to the House of Lords here. Australians can still appeal to the House of Lords as a last resort. Now, if it gets into the Supreme Court 6-3, who gets the six? Who gets the votes?
Listen, Roland, just as a final question, I mean, for anyone, you know, youngsters getting into journalism, what have you got any tips? What words of advice have you got?
Don't do it. It's changed dramatically since I was in it. There is no real journalism. It's all propaganda, left and right. It's propaganda. No, I'd say I shouldn't say don't do it, but be aware that your integrity is going to be tested straight away because it's so partisan. I mean, it's hideous. Everywhere it's flipped down the middle on whether you're left or right. So people go in for the propaganda element. If you're on the left, you propagandize and the journalism suffers it. The integrity suffers. As soon as you go into propaganda, whether it be Russian, Nazi, American, doesn't matter. That's bad. So journalism is, I mean, when I went into it in Australia and in England, there was an element of integrity involved. It doesn't exist. It's which side you're on now and who you're propagandizing for, sadly. And I'm still in it. I'm still writing. I'm writing a lot of books, of course, and I occasionally do a bit of journaling, but really it is a different world. So you've got to buckle up and not forget ideology and try and go in hard in the middle. Maybe it'll swing back, Tony, and there'll be a sudden revelation of, oh, what about the truth in something? Would that be, what about balance? It's gone. Don't you think it's gone? I mean, you're in it.
Yeah, I do. Yeah, I think it's almost impossible to do the job I'm trying to do now. And in fact, even a tin pot community radio station's decided to hoof me off the air here.
Yeah, well, you're in the integrity business. You're asking me about Rothschild. You've been very fair in your questions. I've been as honest as I can't be more honest because I'm telling you what I know, and I'm balanced. I didn't hate Rothschild, but I do see his nefarious activity in the light of 50 years, you know, his operations over half a century. So it's gone. So the journalism today, you're going to end up in a public relations role. There are no what it does, it damages your writing. Because as soon as you begin to propagandize one way or the other, look at Fox in America. It's heavily slanted towards Trump. But CNN is unbelievably ugly in terms of its dissemination of information from a different direction. They hate Trump. I mean, you know, I've got to just say one final thing. What you're doing, what's happening is it gets down to this. You know, you're in the kindergarten, not in the primary kindergarten, in the kindergarten with 4 and 5 year olds. And there's a little guy with yellow hair and spots, and he's fat. And everyone's pointing at him and saying, that's Trump. There's no integrity in the analysis of the man. You know, he's the prime example in the world at the moment. I almost feel sorry for him. I know that will sound crazy, but there's so much against him, and that's propaganda. That's not analysing anything. We mentioned the Middle East. He's been responsible, believe me, for kicking his son-in-law into that and getting those deals done. Now, that's not a bad thing. And I have a different view of him from Australia's point of view, because why are the Russians, you're probably not aware, the Chinese are pushing Australia around at the moment. kicking us in the butt and saying, you know, we're a little tin pot country, and they're stopping all our trade and all this. Why are they doing it now? Two reasons. One, Trump's out, Biden's in. Biden's in their pocket. They can push him around. There'll be no problem taking Taiwan. They've already taken Hong Kong. You need a big, ugly brute like Trump to face these people down. You do need it. I mean, I'm not saying you go for that reason with him, but a nice, gentle soul like Obama, who's a hip guy and cool, and I've just been watching him being interviewed by Seinfeld in comedians in cars getting coffee. And it's, you know, you want to embrace Obama as a wonderful guy, but a very weak president.
Oh, no, you see, you've just brought China in. I've got to ask you about the virus too now. Wuhan, is it all Chinese, this thing?
Yeah, of course it is. See, it's been swamped. They've got a wonderful propaganda arm. And then, believe me, I'll be under the gun now, under the pump. I don't care. Because you broadcast this in Bristol. That'll go back to Beijing. And they'll say, who is this Kylan Perry fellow? We've got to get him. They're really singling out people everywhere because they've got a huge propaganda arm. There are only 3,000. When you talk about the Chinese, it's 3,000 members of the Communist Party. You don't get to be in that little group unless you're a thug. And to get to the right to the top, you've got to be everything. You can't just every province they come out of, you do your homework, they've got to be a thug at the top, a murdering thug. And what has the murdering thug at the top done? He's made himself dictator for life. Why? Because he knows he'll be murdered as soon as he's out, same as Putin. They're all under the pump that way. But we, Wuhan, of course it's Wuhan. Wuhan, no doubt, and I wanted to, I'm even being enfeebled because I'm writing something about it and I'm thinking, oh, do I call it the Wuhan virus? Or this, you know, it's they're saying, oh, they've even said it came in, wait for this, that came in some frozen goods from Australia. Right, our fish apparently have got the virus first. So the machine has gone into overdrive. The Chinese don't know how to operate on the world stage, and they're cocking it up in a bullying way. And you have to have a tough guy to face them down. You can't have sloppy and soppy. And that's why they took Hong Kong, and they're going to do it with Taiwan. That'll be the big test. That'll be the big test in the next few months. Because Trump won't be there, and You watch the Democrats. They will.
Okay. All right. Well, Roland Perry, absolutely fascinating chatting with you. Hope to do it again sometime. Thanks very much for joining us. Your book is The Fifth Man, and it's about the really a biography of the head of the Rothschild family, Victor Rothschild, his role in the Second World War, the Cold War, and also in being a mover and shaker in the behind the scenes in the British Secret Services in the Thatcher era. So thanks very much for joining us.
Yeah, can I just say, you won't get it in bookshops now, only on the net somewhere, but I do urge people to get it, to get a bigger picture of what's happening. Thank you so much. I enjoyed that, Tony. I really did.